Chapter 39. Kelsey groaned as the morning sun blasted her eyelids through the naked window. She rolled over and dragged herself into the shower. Her wet feet slopped across the tiles to the suitcase holding her last clean outfit. Curtains, bath mat, laundry detergent. She recited them in her head as she approached the refrigerator, cursing its emptiness. She donned her jumpsuit and headed for the tram stop. It took a few minutes to track down. She was still getting her bearings around the rental. Having notified her staff that she was taking a personal day, she clutched her backpack and headed to an old district she'd not visited in some time. The rusty iron gatepost felt oddly reassuring to her fingertips. She knocked on the door and stepped back.
"Kelsey,"
said a gray-stubbled man in a delivery uniform.
"Tony?" she replied, astonished. "You're wearing clothes."
How come you didn't ring the bell?"
"That thing works now?
No way." She gave it a push and marveled at the tacky tune that played out.
"Who is it?"
came a familiar yell from the living room. Kelsey peered around the doorway. Her old foster mother was sitting on the sofa, as rotund as ever. Age had taken the fight out of her. Blotches of melanin stained her sagging skin, and a Zimmer frame was parked in front of her seat.
"Here's Kelsey!"
yelled Tony from beside Kelsey's head.
"She's a little deaf now,"
he added in a bad whisper. Kelsey nodded, nursing her ear.
"Hey, kids, get out here, come see your big sister,"
yelled Tony. One of the twins bounded out of the room eagerly with a huge grin across her face.
"Hey, sis,"
yelled the first, tackling her with a bear hug.
"Whoa, steady there, Taylor. Let her settle in before you go knocking her over,"
said Tony. "Good to see you, Taylor," smiled Kelsey. Although the house still stank of beer, Taylor's hair at least smelled of strawberries, even if it was in a putrid chemical kind of way. The second of the late teenage twins slouched out from the bedroom with a surly expression, hands firmly in his pockets. He stumbled over a pair of shoes as he approached, then swore, cursing loudly at whoever left them there, until Taylor pointed out they were his shoes. Kelsey wished she had been able to spend more time doing the coordination exercises with the kids when they were babies. Tony had tried his best, but it left them both wanting.
"Good to see you, little bro,"
said Kelsey, beckoning Seth over for a hug. He gave her a cursory back pat and broke away to skulk in the corridor. He definitely took after his mother in temperament.
"Did you bring the thing?" said Tony anxiously.
"What thing?"
said Taylor excitedly.
"Kelsey's brought a piece of kit that'll make you smart,"
said Tony. Kelsey cringed at his appallingly undiplomatic phrasing, but Taylor didn't seem at all bothered.
"Cool,"
said Taylor.
"Hey, doofus, I'm gonna be smart,"
she added, pretending to karate kick her brother. Seth scowled and shuffled down to the kitchen where he cracked open a beer.
"Do you need this?" asked Tony.
He handed Kelsey a multi-stained, tattered child-rearing manual, the original booklet he'd been given when the twins had been delivered some 18 years ago. Kelsey flicked through it with uneasy nostalgia. It was a miracle anyone had ever raised a kid off such a baffling set of instructions. The workload was utterly impractical. She consoled herself that the revised guidelines she'd introduced were making a practical difference by being actually intelligible to parents.
"No, that's okay, but thank you. I was hoping to speak to both of the twins, just to make sure they understand the procedure. It would be good if you and Stacy hear it too," said Kelsey.
Tony rounded up the twins and cajoled them into position on the couches, ready for Kelsey to present. She unloaded her backpack. In one hand, she held up a brass bowl with a cord attached to it. In the other, a small glass jar containing a pill.
"This is a neurostimulator, and this is a neuroplasticizer," she said, raising each hand in turn.
The room looked at her blankly.
"Together, they form a new experimental remedial treatment being piloted by my department under license from the ministry. I would like to give you both the opportunity to be among the first to receive it. It will help alleviate deficiencies in cognitive processing abilities, including gross and fine motor skills, auditory signal processing, and comprehension. It will require a 12-month commitment to corrective therapy, followed by an intensive 2-year re-education program to reconsolidate the new neural networks in your brain. While there is a bursary available, it is slightly less than you would make were you earning during that period, said Kelsey.
The hell is this bitch babbling on about?
Yelled Stacy.
She's trying to make the kids smart, said Tony.
I'm already smart. I don't need no fancy crap, slurred Seth.
Yeah, you do. You're as dumb as me, jackass,
cheered Taylor. Seth leaned over to thump his twin on the arm, but Tony intervened.
Hey, cut it out. Your big sister's trying to do a good thing here. It's an opportunity. Ask her what you need to know.
Taylor puzzled for a moment, then piped up.
How does it work?
The medication kind of turns your brain to putty, and the therapy helps us to reform it so it's better connected, said Kelsey.
So I'm gonna have a mushy brain?
Said Taylor warily. It will feel weird and probably quite disorienting while the treatment's going on, which is why the first year would be residential, to ensure you're always in safe hands, said Kelsey.
What if it goes wrong? Said Seth.
It's a risk, a small one, but it's there. Worst case scenario, long-term cognitive impairment. Potentially an indefinite reversion to childhood, which would result in long-term dependency, but that's highly unlikely. We've modeled this extensively using our existing child techniques, and the chance of success is more than 90%. But really, the most important thing here is whether or not this is something you want. It's a big commitment, and...
I'm down,
said Taylor excitedly. Kelsey smiled softly. That's wonderful, Taylor. But you don't have to decide right now. I'm going to leave some brochures here for you all to read, and I'll come back in a week to see where you're at. If you have any questions in the meantime, you can always come by my office. Kelsey passed the sample items around the room and listened to Taylor's stories about a new boy at her supermarket who stacks the aisle 2 down from her. Her wristwatch chimed.
Eek, I've got to fly.
Take care, everyone. Think about what I said and read the brochures together, please, said Kelsey. Gathering her things, she made a hasty exit. Seth paced after her across the broken paving slabs.
Wait up. This brain thing, is there another way?
He asked. Kelsey paused and looked at him. She could see his mother's hostile face lurking in his scowl, but also his father's earnestness. There is, but it would take around 12 years, and there's no guarantee it would work as effectively.
What's it called?
Going back to school, said Kelsey. Kelsey rocked up to the family house an hour later, feeling flustered. Damien and Leon were helping to load up the car with Olive's things.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. I'm here now, she puffed.
Wow, Mom's actually around to help. That's a first,
snarked Damien.
She can't be worse than Dad. He's done nothing all day,
piped up Leon. Kelsey grabbed the top box from the stack Damien was carrying as he wobbled under the weight, passing it to the empty-handed Leon.
What can I do?
She said with forced brightness.
Get Dad out of the basement, said Olive, heading back inside.
Kelsey groaned and headed downstairs. Michael was hunched over his desk, scribbling frantically.
What are you doing? Said Kelsey.
She can't go. I found strong evidence that the water at the university is unsafe. Look at these reports. Do you see the bromine levels?
Kelsey took the paper and glanced over it.
Where did you even find this?
She asked, turning the copied pages.
The water company has a public records library, said Michael.
This report's over 60 years old, Michael, said Kelsey, slapping it back down.
So?
So what's this really about?
Michael turned away bashfully. His shoulders twitched and he tried to stifle a sob. Kelsey placed a consoling hand on his shoulder.
I don't want her to go. She won't be safe.
Of course she will.
You're just being your usual paranoid self, said Kelsey.
Don't touch me. I don't deserve your sympathy. I put our family in danger, said Michael.
If this is about the old man at the library, you have got to move past that. If the feds were going to charge you, they would have done it by now, said Kelsey.
That's exactly my point. They haven't come for me, which means they'll be going for someone close to me. It's how they work, said Michael.
Nonsense.
They covered up a man's death, even though it was witnessed by dozens of people. They can do anything they want, said Michael.
But why would the feds bother with us?
The feds don't care.
It's that detective who cares. She's got it in for our family like a vendetta. She threatened us, you know. When they couldn't press charges, she said there would still be consequences. I think she means our family, said Michael, welling up. A knot tightened in Kelsey's stomach. The detective didn't strike her as the type to make idle threats or to take losing lightly. She stared at Michael with revulsion. You're telling me our daughter's in danger because of what you did? Said Kelsey. Gone was the reassuring, weary tone from years of soothing Michael's anxiety and checking his meds. This was a credible threat he had brought on their house, and the anger in her voice was palpable. Fix it. I don't care how, Michael. Just make it go away. Okay? Olive called from upstairs, hurrying them. Coming, sweetie, Kelsey replied. She turned back to Michael and leaned into his ear. Not a word of this to the kids. Get your act together and let's go. The porters were smartly dressed in waistcoats and ties. Michael followed Kelsey and Olive through the red brick archway into the stone cabin, where a wizened woman with a dragonfly brooch greeted them.
Olive Hadley,
she said, scrolling down the list of newbies.
Ah, yes, here you go. Oh, it looks like someone's changed your room. You'll be in the newly refurbished G4 in the main courtyard.
The porter slapped a key on the desk and Olive signed it out. The trio took a campus map and proceeded into the main courtyard, dragging a large wooden cart laden with Olive's possessions. The scale of the campus astonished Michael. He'd been past the complex so many times, but he'd never appreciated how many buildings, private gardens, and courts were packed into its hallowed walls. Automatons with bowler hats glided through the stone courtyards as they navigated their way past the great fountain and the old alchemy labs to Olive's residence block. Across the lawn, a stooped figure traversed the cloisters. Michael peered closer, recognizing the face. He had aged somewhat in nearly 2 decades, but the man's features were unmistakable. It was the scholar he'd accosted outside the ministry all those years ago. He was clutching a briefcase close to his chest. Michael wondered if it contained the fragile leaves that he'd glimpsed last time. As if sensing his gaze, the man looked outward. He locked eyes with Michael and stopped in his tracks. His mouth fell open as he recognized him instantly. Michael hastily pressed on after the others, praying they hadn't noticed the silent interaction. He dragged the wooden cart faster, hurrying Olive and Kelsey onwards until they were well into the next courtyard. He glanced backwards over his shoulder. There was no sign of the old scholar. Perhaps he was busy reporting them. Michael, this way, called Kelsey as she and Olive marched across to the far side. Ivy swept across the front of the ancient brickwork, licking at timber frames and leaded windows. They parked the cart by the base of a twisting wooden staircase, then carried up the first load of Olive's belongings. Stepping into her new room, Olive squealed with excitement. The carpet was faded, with bleached patches where stains had been rubbed out. Dust swirled in the sunlight streaming through the old latticed windows. A tatty-looking armchair occupied one corner. Opposite was a single bed, and adjacent to that, a small refrigerator.
"It's perfect!" cried Olive.
She ran and jumped onto the bed, which creaked loudly. Kelsey and Michael dumped their heavy loads and looked around with curiosity. Michael ran his finger over the windowsill, noting the thick coating of dust. The paintwork was chipped around the edges, and one of the diamond-shaped window panes had recently been replaced. He moved to the chest of drawers. There were mug rings and scuff marks imprinted on the wood, alongside 2 faint crimson stains. Michael's eyes moved to the bleached carpet and a chill swept over him.
Are you sure you're happy in this room?
Maybe we should see if you can be moved, he said uneasily.
Are you kidding me? This place is awesome. Look at the view. I can see the lawn. I've got that old cedar tree surrounded by stone archways. It's like a palace.
Kelsey beamed with pride, stroking the shabby old fabric. There was definitely a romantic quality to the centuries-old place.
We should move her, whispered Michael.
Are you mad? We've only just got here, said Kelsey.
I think something bad happened in this room, said Michael.
So what if it did, said Kelsey. What if they switched her to this room when they saw she was with me?
What are you talking about?
Think about it. It's how they punished me all those years ago, through my grandfather. What if they do it again? They're going to get me through Olive. She's not safe here, hissed Michael.
What happened to Amal? was nothing to do with the ministry punishing you, Michael. It was probably baked into him as an embryo. Congenital defects were common in his generation, and some manifested late in life.
You can't be sure. God, we should never have let her come here, hissed Michael.
So what? We should just keep her cooped up at home? Wrapped in cotton wool for her whole adult life? Get a grip. And for the record, if anyone has put her at risk, it's you. When you took it upon yourself to push someone off a goddamned roof, snarled Kelsey.
That's not what happened, I told you already. It's Rich, you throwing that back in my face after what you did. Do you really want to have that conversation?
What conversation? Interjected Olive, sidling over. Nothing, sweetie, said Kelsey, glaring at Michael.
Can you two please stop arguing just for today?
Begged Olive.
Of course. Sorry.
I think we need to buy you some essentials. Shall we find the campus store? Said Kelsey, sweeping her daughter in a side hug.
I'll stay here, said Michael.
Okay, but Dad, don't go through my stuff again. I know you did the other day, and it was not cool, said Olive.
Michael's mouth hung open, embarrassed, as his daughter and his estranged wife departed. He peered from the window and watched them disappear across the courtyard, then scoured the room for security weaknesses, concealed entrances, anything he could conceive of. His eyes fell on the room key, which Olive had left on the dresser. Seizing it, he hastened downstairs, only to run into a new family arriving, laden with bags.
"Hey, nice to meet you," said the mother, waggling her fingers beneath several heavy straps. "Are you on moving duty, too?"
Yes. My daughter's just moved in upstairs. Do you want a quick hand?"
he said, trying his best to appear normal.
"Oh, would you mind? Thanks ever so much. There's more on the cart," said the mother.
She stepped away to reveal a cart brimming with an absurd number of possessions.
"I didn't realize all three of you were moving in," he muttered, grabbing a stack of boxes.
Michael carried two loads to their flat, then extricated himself from the offers of tea and cake, which somehow they'd already managed to extract from the traveling circus. He hurried through the courtyards out into town.
"I need a copy of this," he said.
He slapped the key down on the locksmith's counter and glanced at his watch. It had taken him 20 minutes to walk there. If he wasn't back soon, Olive and Kelsey would get suspicious. The locksmith eyed it up and looked at Michael.
"ID card?"
he said. Michael hesitated.
"Do I pay in advance?"
"It's a ministry lock. Anyone who requests a key copy has to submit their ID. Ministry system does a quick check, and then on we go. Prevents fraud."
What if I forgot my ID pass?" said Michael.
"Not carrying your ID is a felony."
"Of course, yes. Let me just double check," said Michael, patting himself down.
"This is your key, sir," said the locksmith, frowning.
It would appear I'm unable to pay. I'll just take my key and come back another time," said Michael.
The locksmith snatched the key away.
"Sorry, sir, but I'm obliged to keep any keys which fail an ownership test. I'm required to return them to the ministry. If it is indeed yours, they will see that it's returned to you in short order."
Michael's face paled.
No. I can't go back without it."
"It's not my decision, sir."
Michael dived onto the counter, grabbing the locksmith's arm.
"Are you insane? Get off me! Security!"
The man groped for the security button by the cashier, but Michael had his other hand pinned. Michael prized the key from his fingertips, then leaped from the counter. The locksmith lunged at the button, triggering an alarm. Michael fled the store as heads turned. He weaved his way through the winding old side streets before slowing to a brisk walk. Catching his breath, he melded into the stream of parents and freshers flowing toward the university entrance. He gave a confident wave to the wizened porter, who somehow remembered his face from earlier, and slipped through into the main courtyard. When he reached Olive's apartment, it was deserted. There was a ruckus from the door opposite. He heard Kelsey's voice and Olive's laugh. He took a second to compose himself, then knocked and stepped in.
"Ah, the traveler returns," declared the other mother. "Kelsey, your husband was an angel earlier, and helped us lug all of Tarquin's things up these creaky old stairs."
"What a jolly good egg he is,"
said Kelsey in a mock posh accent, making Olive snort with laughter again. Her laughter stopped when she saw Michael's sweaty brow and bedraggled hair. She cringed all the way into her armchair.
"Where did you go, dearest?"
said Kelsey.
"Dearest?"
Michael read the script immediately. Clearly, they were playing happy families today. make a good first impression with Tarquin and the yuppies.
I was looking for you, my love.
We should probably be leaving, said Michael. We're all having a nice time. I don't see a burning urgency, said Kelsey curtly.
No, well, you wouldn't, snapped Michael.
Maybe you should go, Dad. You look tired, said Olive.
She leaped up and hastily led him to the door.
You don't have to stay here, whispered Michael.
Dad, I want to be here. Quit worrying for 2 minutes, will you? I'm fine. I'll catch you soon.
Wait, I've got your...
Olive cut him off with a kiss on the cheek, then closed the door in his face. More than 12 hours later, Michael hurried across the stone paving to his daughter's block, shivering. His breath misted in the air. He was freezing, having waited over an hour for the night porter to step away from the front desk. With no torrent of new arrivals to hide among, stealth had been the only option. It had taken longer than planned, but he'd finally made it back inside the university campus. The hairs on his neck tingled in the pale rays of dawn. He had to be quick. He crossed the deserted courtyard to Olive's stairwell. By the entrance was a series of enamel pipes. He zeroed in on his daughter's name and plucked her room key from his pocket. He stuffed the key in her mailbox and turned. It wouldn't open. Michael checked the giant clock face on the front of the banquet hall. 5:59 a.m. The mailboxes were always sealed in the minutes before 6 a.m., presumably to allow the vacuum mechanism to work. He danced from side to side, rubbing his arms as he waited for the clock to chime. A shining glint caught his eye, moving through the cloisters. An automaton glided into the courtyard. Cursing, Michael ducked down behind the mailbox. Vapor from his hot breath billowed upwards like a smoke signal. The machine's head rotated with a series of mechanical clicks as it focused on Michael's position. The machine glided towards him. It was slower than usual on the uneven paving stones, but its caterpillar tracks were sturdy and still made it faster than a human. As Michael searched wildly for an escape route, the courtyard clock chimed 6. Leaping up, he thrust the key into the lock once again, begging for mercy. The machine was closing in fast. Its cold eyes were locked on Michael's shivering figure. He turned the key with a cry. The archaic hatch fell open with a clang, revealing a barren, empty chamber. Michael slumped backwards as relief crashed over him. In the same moment, the automaton's powerful arms raised him from the ground, snapping him out of his trance. Michael cried out in protest, kicking and squirming as he dangled by the scruff of his neck, rasping for air. He clawed at its impassive face, begging for release, but the machine was deaf to his words and unmoved by the contortions of pain across his face. Its grip was firm and precise, applying no direct pressure to Michael's body, merely clutching his collar and letting gravity strangle him under his own body weight.
Help me,
rasped Michael.
Olive!
He kicked out, striking the mailboxes beside him with a clang. Michael kicked again, harder and louder, with every last bit of strength in his body. His eyesight failed. His legs fell limp. A window burst open. A woman screamed. Michael blacked out. Sometime later, Michael came to. He was on a bed and something was covering his mouth. He fumbled around groggily until his hand made sense of the oxygen mask strapped over his face. He tugged it off and sat up, taking in his surroundings. It was somewhere between an infirmary and a police cell. On the wall was a university emblem and a photo of some academic he didn't recognize. A thin, scratchy blanket covered his legs. He drew it tight around his shivering body, then reached for the mug of hot tea by his bedside, seeking to revive his fuzzy brain further. No sooner had he taken a sip than he spat it out, spraying tea everywhere as he scrambled back, terrified. The same automaton that had accosted him in the courtyard now stood guard in the corner of the room, staring at him. The mug shattered across the floor as he recoiled. Almost instantly, the cell door flung open and Olive rushed in.
Dad, are you okay? They wouldn't let me in while you were unconscious. They said you needed to recover.
Get that thing away from me.
Relax, Dad. It's not going to hurt you. Just drink the... Ugh, right. Now I need to find you more meds. Great.
What was in the tea? Said Michael, baffled.
Nothing, just your usual stuff, all right?
You know about that?
Duh. Before Mom moved out, she showed me where you kept it, so I could check you were taking it like you should. I'm guessing you skipped yesterday's dose, huh?
That's none of your... Why am I here? What even is this room?
It's a holding cell, normally for drunk students, but apparently today it's for my doofus dad, who won't take his meds,
scowled Olive.
The machine. It tried to kill me, whispered Michael.
No, Dad, it didn't. It restrained you because you were trespassing. It thought you were a threat to the students.
Why would I hurt a student?
I'm not saying you would, Dad. But maybe you could start by telling me what the hell you were doing in the first place.
Michael shook his head despondently. You wouldn't understand.
Don't dismiss me. I'm not a kid anymore. I've put up with this kind of stuff from you for years. It's not cute anymore. It's not quirky or under control. You're behaving like a genuinely crazy person.
Look at these marks and tell me I'm making it up,
protested Michael, showing the raw skin around his neck.
I'm not denying you got kind of strangled. I'm asking what the hell you were doing trying to break into my mail at the crack of dawn, she snapped.
I was trying to protect you, said Michael.
From what? Making friends like a normal fresher? Mission accomplished.
From the ministry.
That doesn't make any sense.
They're using you to get to me, to punish me.
For what?
Mistakes I've made.
You're punishing yourself, Dad. You've been doing it for years, and it's making you miserable, she said.
If you knew what I knew, began Michael.
I know enough. I know about your little research project, for one. All those weird deaths you've been obsessing over. Yeah, that's right. I broke into your conspiracy factory in the basement. Took me weeks to find the key to the desk, and what did I find? A full-on crazy person's drawer. But I thought, hey, I can see past this. He's still a good dad. So what if he's got a hobby that's absolutely insane? I'll bring it up later. Then, you and Mom decided to divorce or go on a break or whatever the hell it is you two are doing, and suddenly, you were too fragile to confront about anything. Maybe I should have said something sooner. In a way, it was all leading to something like this.
How can you say that? If you truly saw my research, you'd know what's at stake. Our world, our deaths, the ministry is lying to us, begged Michael.
Listen to yourself, Dad! You've got a problem. And no wonder it's gotten worse, with the amount of free time you have these days.
What do you mean?
I know you don't have a job. Were you planning on telling us ever, or were you just going to wait until we got evicted? Who do you think paid the last two bills? It wasn't Mom, that's for sure, because she's moved out, assuming you had it covered. I'm not there to cover you this month, Dad, so you're going to have to get it together pretty quick.
Yes. Yes, I'll fix the money.
Of course.
I need to get my report published first. You understand that, don't you? People need the truth, but I can't publish it. They've already threatened you once, wept Michael.
Who?
The ministry.
We're back to this again?
All I want for you is to be safe and happy.
Right now, the biggest threat to my well-being is you, Dad. Until you can admit you've got a problem, we're done here. I need you to leave me alone for a long while. If anything like this happens again, it will be me going to the police, not the university.
Olive, pleaded Michael.
But she was gone. He slumped his head against the table and groaned in despair. From the opposite side of the room, the door opened again. A familiar voice greeted him.
Kids, eh?
Michael dragged his head from the table and groaned as a familiar red ponytail and trench coat entered. Clerkenwell took a seat opposite him, chomping merrily on an almond croissant, shedding pastry flakes across her half-tucked shirt.
Do they have other cops in the city, or is it just you? Groaned Michael.
I could say the same about criminals.
I'm not a criminal, I'm...
Misunderstood? No doubt. I was just about to finish my shift for the day when we got the call. I heard your name and I couldn't resist. I guess part of me was curious as to what you'd screwed up this time. Trespass?
The door opened again and Michael sat up astonished. Val entered, looking impeccably dressed for the hour. Clerkenwell doffed an imaginary cap to Michael's mother before taking another generous bite of croissant.
Some retirement you're having, Miss Hadley. Your family like to keep you busy, don't they?
Stony-faced, Val took a seat at the foot of Michael's bed and stared coldly at the detective.
Are you planning on arresting my client?
Well, let's see now. He was caught trespassing while trying to infiltrate another citizen's mail, and now he's lying to police by trying to claim he's not a criminal. I make that 3 charges to get us started, so yeah, probably going to be arresting him.
Shrugged Clerkenwell.
From my understanding, the only witness was the campus automaton, and machines can't be called upon to testify as sole witnesses, meaning you don't have a case,
said Val.
Ah, but there is a human witness, isn't there? Your client's daughter. You expect her to testify against her own father? She doesn't have a choice. She will be called as a witness, and she will be obliged to tell the truth. She will exercise her right to silence. We'll see. Sometimes family can surprise you,
smiled the detective.
Are you arresting my client or not? No, but only because it's late and I don't want to go back to the station. I'll release your client under caution for now. We'll be in touch should the university decide to seek prosecution.
Val rose silently and marched to the door where the automaton stood sentry. She glared at the machine defiantly until it opened the door. Michael scarpered after her, not daring to look at the machine directly.
See you soon,
called Clerkenwell. Michael had to double-step to keep pace with his mother. She stayed half a pace ahead, striding in pointed silence until they were several blocks clear of the university.
You seem determined to make the same mistakes as your father,
she snapped.
It's the opposite, Mom. I'm trying to avoid his mistakes. I want my family to be safe, that's all,
choked Michael.
They are safe. You're the one jeopardizing that. I trust you've learned the truth about Olive.
Michael nodded.
Then you should be keeping your head down, not pulling ridiculous stunts like this. No good can come of meddling with the ministry's processes. You should have learned that years ago.
Someone's got to challenge them, said Michael.
What does that even mean?
She snapped.
The system's rigged. People should be allowed to choose.
His mother's face fell.
Don't tell me you're one of them.
One of who?
The deniers, the tin hats, the idiots who ignore the choice they're given, deny the choice they've made, and pursue their own insanity at the cost of everyone around them.
Michael said nothing for a while as he followed his marching mother to her car.
How did you know to come for me? He said after a while.
Your daughter told me what had happened. I figured you must be out of your mind trying something like that, so thought it best to have some sane legal representation.
She doesn't want to see me again, said Michael.
Can you blame her?
How do I keep her safe if I can't see her?
Val said nothing as she climbed into the car. He reached for the passenger door, but she pulled away, leaving him alone in the street. Michael's eyes moved to the ministry dome on the horizon, which rose high above the surrounding buildings. If he was going to take on the system, he would have to go it alone. But he would not be silenced anymore. Drawing his coat tight around him, he set off for home at speed.